Dick Shimon down at the railway station in Douglas, and looking back over the years, when did you start working?
I started here in 1942. I was 15, and I was just a general assistant, what they called a Doug's buddy in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I got called up, and later when I returned, demobbed, the mechanic in charge of the 16 lorries had left. So I was told to take over. I wasn't asked, I was told to take over his work, which included the painting, the mechanical work, the lettering. And there was also a 1926 Morris at Glenwillan, Morris Commercial, which we had to do.
Who would be the manager here at the time then?
At the time, A.M. Sheard was the secretary and manager,
mm-hmm.
and he was directly to the shareholders, to the bosses, to the shareholders and directors. Evan Kane was the general office manager. Arthur Conrad was the audit office manager.
Yeah.
Moses Kelly was the traffic inspector. He was the first man in uniform.
Yeah.
And Nelson Taylor was the Douglas station master, also in uniform. There were two Douglas signalmen that used to alternate signal 1 week, points to the shunting the next week.
Yeah.
The steam sheds over where we've just been.
Yes, we're just looking at them. Been looking at those.
The blacksmiths, joiners, painters, permanent waste staff all had sheds up there.
And what were the journey times for the trains?
Right, 50 minutes to Port Erin. There were 8 stations, 2 unmanned, Port Suddock and Ballabeg.
Yeah.
It was 45 minutes to Peel, 4 stations, all manned. And 45 from St John's to Ramsey, which used to be the Manx Northern Railway. The only one unmanned there was St German's. Now the freight side of it was very busy with your cars and sand and gravel and coal and livestock from the marts in to Douglas to the slaughterhouse.
So when they brought those animals in here then, as we're at the sort of at the top end of the railway yard here.
Yeah,
what was the procedure? How did they come out and get?
They come in cattle trucks to pens over there.
Yeah,
which were built.
That's
up
where the buses are at the moment.
The pens were built up to the same level of the floor of the cattle trucks.
Mm-hmm.
The cattle were driven out of the trucks into the pens. Then the slaughterhouse people would come along and take them, half a dozen at a time or whatever.
Right. So there'd be a lot of trade in animals then, wouldn't
there? Well, 3 days a week. Ballasalus and John's and Ramsey marts.
Right.
And then the heavy cargo carted by lorry from Douglas, basically from the steam packet, building site stuff. Ronaldsway Aircraft was the first big building we carted the steelwork out to.
Yeah.
And they were building it opposite the airport.
Mm-hmm.
The brewery, seed merchants out of town, and holiday luggage, which was called PLA, Passenger Luggage in Advance, which you would send over ahead of you coming on holiday, labelled, to your hotel on the island.
Mm-hmm.
We would pick it up at the steam packet or directly off the boat and deliver it to whatever it was addressed to.
Yeah. So how many staff would be employed by the Isleman Rail?
Roughly over 200, or about 200. That's throughout the island.
Right.
That includes station staff, permanent waste staff, and repairmen, fitters and whatever.
How would the guard communicate with the driver?
Right, the communication was with the guard. He had 3 flags, red, green and white. The white flag was to take off. The green flag was when he was all clear, go ahead.
Mm.
Or the red flag if he needed to stop him, if someone came on running up late.
Yeah.
He also had a whistle to draw the driver's attention when it was ready to go, if the driver wasn't watching.
What about in the hours of darkness then?
Well, they had a hand lamp which had 3 different coloured lenses, red, green and a clear glass.
Yeah.
The red was obviously if he waved the lamp to the engine driver was to stop his train on takeoff again.
Yeah.
The green was all clear to go ahead, and the white clear glass was just to walk about and see what he was doing. The phone between stations was private as such. Each phone, there was a box with a small handle, and each station had its own code, like a short blast or a long blast on the handle to operate a whistle, a bell at the stations. And like Port Suddock would be 1 short, 1 long, Santon was 2, Ballasalla 3 long. Then you go to Castletown, one short, one long, and so forth throughout the island, different stations. The Douglas outside public phone, the Douglas number was 26.
Right.
But to get there, you had to go through the operator, because you couldn't dial direct.
No, of course. No, no.
Now, on the level crossings in the country, there are still some small stone-built huts. And the gatekeeper didn't actually live in them, but spent the day in there.
Yes.
Opening the gates and closing them as the trains were due. And the driver would whistle when he was approaching these level crossings.
Right. Mm. What about the checking of the track and that sort of thing?
Permanent way staff would do that. Each morning, very early, each section, one man would walk his length, like from here to Union Mills, Union Mills to Crosby and so forth. Mm. Before the first train came along.
Yeah.
And he had to give the all clear at the end of his section, whether everything was okay or not. The out-of-town station staff took their meals between trains and just had to fit it in as best as possible.
Because there'd be a lot of trains in those days.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, the out-of-town station masters, if we find a guards van, I'll show you, there's a security locker inside the guards van where the station masters used to put their cash bag into so nobody could get it out again because it dropped to the bottom into a drawer.
Right.
But when it came into Douglas, one of the audit staff had the key to open the drawer and take the cash bags out.
So it was a secure system?
Yes. And this was done daily into Douglas.
Right. Wasn't there a special Tinwell coach?
There is a coach somewhere. We called it the Governor's coach, but I believe now they call it the Queen's coach.
Mm.
Used only on Tinwell Day for MHKs and the Governor and directors of company to go to Tinwell.
Yes, I think it's still around here somewhere.
We'll have a look around and see if we can find it.
Let's do that.
Mm.
Well, we're just passing a coach here now, and the old handles still turn, but I can't open the door, so there must be a locking system.
There is a locking system. There's a square-ended key which goes into that.
Oh, it's just a little hole there.
Yeah, and you turn the key, much like an ordinary key, but it was only a square end on it. That unlocked the door, then you had to unlock it with this. But these have also got a child-proof spring.
Ah.
The little children hanging out through the windows could take the handle to there, but they had to put some pressure on.
Oh, right.
To open properly. But the children always, you see the straps on the windows.
Yes.
The children always unload them.
The windows are a bit rattly, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
But the Victorians seemed to think of everything, really, didn't they?
They did, yes. It was all very good. Of course, they've got two chains and a special coupling on between the carriage, and this is the vacuum pipe.
Oh, yes.
The engine built up a vacuum which operated the brakes on the wheels.
And then it's the linkage we're talking about between the two carriages.
Right.
Of course, where we're walking now on this platform, this was covered with a very large canopy, wasn't it?
Both platforms were covered with a canopy. And also across the building, at the front of the building there, well, it's the back of the building, actually, from the roadside.
Yeah.
But there was a large canopy over that area as well.
Which was the office, then?
Right. The one with the bow window on the top upstairs was the boss's office, A.M. Sheard.
Ah.
And he used to often stand in that window because you could see all over the area.
Good vantage
you
point.
You couldn't see him. And next to it, upstairs again, is general office. Evan Kane was in charge. And further along, the audit office, Arthur Conrad was in charge.
Where all these cars are now parked here on that area across from the rails, were there other buildings there?
Yes, there used to be a large warehouse there where all the margarine and soap that came into the island was stored for delivery to shops and stores and whatever.
Mm.
And then Birdseye Frozen Foods, when they came out, they built a large refrigerated building on the back of it. And all the frozen food coming into the island went through that. And then behind that again was what we call the goods shed, where a rail went into it and loaded vans could be shunted into the goods shed to have potatoes for Harry Fell or grain for the farmers or whoever, unloaded in the shed and piled up ready for collection.
And where was your work area, Dick?
My shed workshop was here by the toilets.
Oh, right, down by the station buildings, yes.
Yeah, underneath Peel Road houses.
Yeah.
Next to the canteen, as it were.
So you had quite a lot of vehicles to look after then?
16.
And where did you go for your fuel and
so? Oh, we went, all the lorries went to the different bus garages, because the bus company and the railway company, well, the railway company actually bought the bus company when it started up, and they ran it. So we used to get our petrol and diesel there. But we had Austin's, Morris's, Connor's, a Dodge, two AEC lorries, which are long wheelbase made from buses.
Mm.
Thornycroft, again made from 20-seater buses. And this old Morris Commercial at Glenwillan.
Well, you've been keen to see this coach, the Governor's coach. Well, they call it the Royal Coach now.
Well, they call it the Queen's Coach now, I believe. But we used to call it the Governor's Coach, which was only used on a Tynwald day to take out the Governor, MHKs and their retinue and company directors. You'll notice the very plush blue upholstery, royal blue upholstery.
Yes.
With the armrests, even curtains for the windows, blue carpet on the floor.
There must be a bar in here somewhere as well.
Well, it could have been. It was really posh. And of course there had to be an attendant stood at the back here at all times while the coach was being used.
And if you look through this section here, it's difficult to see them, but there are some old photographs or prints of various stations and areas,
St. John's, as it used to be.
Did you ever ride in that?
Not in this one, no.
No.
No staff were not allowed in. But there used to be an attendant had to stand here at the back on Tynwald Day.
I've never had your full name. I've always called you Dick Shimon.
Yeah, Richard Stanley Shimon.
Richard Stanley.
Now, Richard goes, and Stanley goes back in the Shimon family, as far as I can get, to 1840, when I had a great uncle died, and he's buried in Maloo Church. But the Shimons always lived around the centre of the island.
Yeah.
We, Foxdale mining, when the mines closed, we moved up to a place called the Vaish up above Crunkavoddy. And from there, they moved to Borsion.
Now that's where your life starts, really, isn't it?
I was born in Borsion.
What date would that be?
1927.
Yeah.
In Borsion. And we moved out of Borsion 2 years later, in 1929, to this farm, Mullany Cloy, which means mill on the hedge.
We're in part of what was that farm now, of course, but it's the estate's a bit split up.
Well, today, the two fields across the road are the sports fields for the parish, and the fields further up now have all been taken up by the Forestry Board for a nursery, for growing young shrubs and bushes and plants and whatever. Oh, the whole area. It used to be 50 acres of a farm.
Well, we've just looked at the mill there, but before we get to that, I mean, you've got memories of childhood life in farming, haven't you?
Oh, yes. It goes back a long way. Even coming to here, I started school here at 4 years old. You shouldn't have started school till I was five, but brother was going, and I cried my eyes out so much I wanted to go with him, so I started at four. But when you come home from school, the standard procedure on a farm then was you bring the cows in for milking from across the road, no traffic, no problem. Or you go up and count the sheep, and during lambing time you were sent up to the top fields to check the sheep that they were all right, none of them were having problems. And we were, even 5-6 years old, acting as midwives to sheep.
Really?
Yeah. But it was just standard procedure, you know. And
you grew up with it?
Yeah. Even today, I go roaming about the hills, and at lambing time, I keep looking over the hedge for a sheep that's not too well.
Yeah.
I found one or two up on Douglas Head on the Marine Drive
a
couple of years ago in trouble, and I helped them. But I didn't see them, because I don't know who owns the sheep up there.
No. So that was just part of your childhood growing up, really?
Yes,
well,
yes. And every farm had a dog, some had two.
Now, you didn't live in where the mill house actually is, but the farmhouse was built much later than the mill.
Yes, well, the mill house is on the roadside. It's now a whitewashed building. And that was built hundreds of years ago. But the main house, as it is now, Mullany Cloy House, dry stone mostly, was built at the turn of the century. Now, in the back corner of it, the room at the back was the dairy, which was as good as any fridge, because it had a big stone slate bench. It had stone dishes, like you see clay dishes, and they were very cold. The milk was poured into these dishes from milking, warm. As it cooled, what wasn't needed for sale or for home use was put in what they called the churn, which was a barrel on a frame on a spindle with a handle on one side. The milk would be poured in, maybe 10-12 gallon of milk, and the children had to take turns churning this milk until about an hour later Mum or Granny would take the top off, unscrew the things, take the lid off and check, and then maybe 2 inches of butter on top of the milk, which would be scooped off and put into platter dishes, as they call them. They had two little wooden spades, platters, that they used to knock the juice out of the
butter. Pat them together with them,
and to knock the water out of the milk out of the butter and then put it into blocks.
Yeah.
And it was left then in on the stone slab dishes, on the dairy shelf, in the cold, just like any fridge. And then once a week the baker would come around.
What was left in that churn though?
Buttermilk. Now buttermilk was lovely. It was really great.
I used to love buttermilk myself.
We would drink as much as we wanted of it.
Yes.
And the other children coming up to help would be drinking it. And what was left over would be put in a separate dish. And after a meal, drink of buttermilk. It was really lovely, it was.
What was done to clean the churns then?
That was just done with hot soapy water.
Oh, was it?
And there was a special, what they call a churn brush, which is very much like today's mop.
Yeah.
Like a brush on a long handle. Because the churn barrel was about 4 feet deep. And you had to reach in and really scrub it clean.
Yes.
And then there was a big wooden circular dish put underneath the frame, and the barrel would be turned upside down and left to drain into this dish.
Mm.
And then when it was dry, it would be wiped out with a kitchen tea cloth or whatever.
So this had to be done every day then, was it?
No, once a week.
Oh, once a week?
Once a week, yes.
Right.
And then,
the cleaning, but the churning of the butter would be every day, would it?
No, that was the milk would be all saved up.
Oh, I see.
Just used once a week.
Right.
But then when it was always done to correspond with the baker and the butcher coming round.
Oh.
Now the baker would come round with his bread, but he also had tea, sugar, bags of salt, all sorts of kitchen utensils.
More of a grocer, wasn't
he? Yes, he was, a travelling grocer. But instead of getting paid in cash, he would be paid in butter, milk, cheese, and chickens if he ordered them the week before.
Right.
Dead, ready dressed for cooking. All this was done by barter.
Yeah.
And nobody ever argued. In fact, some of the farmers used to meet up after he'd been and compare notes to see who got the best deal. But it wasn't just him. There was another chap used to come around, a big black van. Now, what did he sell? I think he was a butcher, travelling butcher. But he also sold fish and stuff like that, you know. And he did the same thing, bartering.
Right.
But he came on the same day as the baker, but later on. I think they more or less worked it between them, so the stuff that they got would be dead fresh, not from the week before kind of thing.
So your vegetables would all be grown on for the farm anyway?
Well, yes, the first year, a rotation cultivation. The first year a field would be grass, would be ploughed, harrowed, like raked, to break up the soil, rolled until it was flat, and then grain sown on it. Now the grain could be either corn, barley or wheat, or even all three in the same field in different sections. Then that would be in the early spring. At the end of the summer that would be harvested, cut and stacked behind the farm buildings into stacks and covered with thatch like they did to the old cottages in the old days. Which is the thatch is what we used to get from up on the hillside. Cut it and bring it down to thatch the stacks. And then during the winter, a contractor would come around with his thrashing machine pulled by a steam engine. And it would go from farm to farm. And the farmers from each farm helped each other to do the thrashing, as it was called. The corn, wheat or barley would be fed into the top of this machine on a platform, down through the drums. The grain would come out one end into sacks, and the straw would come out into the other end, either into bundles and tied up, or into bales if there was a baling machine later on in the years. But the whole thing was done in one day.
Yeah.
Then he would move on to the next farm. And it was all done in rotation, so each farmer knew that he'd be here with me today, I mustn't have anything to do tomorrow, I'll go to John's tomorrow.
Yes.
And this is how it went on. It was really well organised.
Now, how much mechanisation was there on the farm when you were a youngster then? There'd be none at all, I suppose.
We just the two horses. They'd pull the plough to do the ploughing, the harrows to harrow, which was a three-sectioned rake, the roller to roll it flat, one horse pulled the roller, and then when the grain was ready for cutting, the two horses again would call what they called the binder, which cut the grain down to ground level, and it went through the binder.
Came out in sheaves.
And came out in sheaves,
yes.
Which was stacked into stooks, as we call them, till they were dry enough to bring home for stacking. And then the horses again would plough the field after it was finished, all the seed was taken off. They'd plough it again for the following year for vegetables,
yeah.
And ridge it into ridges for potatoes, turnips, carrots, cauliflowers, cabbages, the lot.
Yeah.
And all these vegetables were sold then to a wholesale contractor who had stores in the towns, you know. On pre-arranged dates he would come out and take what he wanted. And then at the end of that year the field would be just flattened and left until the following spring, ploughed again and already sorted for another sowing of grain for the third year. But as the grain was beginning to come through the ground, there would be grass seeds sown on top of it.
All right.
Now, at the end of the summer, the grain was ready for cutting, but the grass was just beginning to come through. So the grain was cut down to about 6 inches and left for the grass to grow up for the following year, which was called hayfield.
Right.
And that was cut then in the following spring and stored away for the feeding of animals during the winter. That was the fourth year. And then it was left for 1 year to graze. And then the whole routine would start again.
And of course, we're talking here about mixed farming, presumably, aren't we?
Yes, yes. It was 50 acres, our average farm. And we had about 30 sheep, 8 cows, 2 horses, 4 pigs, and 2 sheepdogs. I think that was it.
Was there many men on the farm then?
No,
or not?
Just the family.
Right.
Dad and us 2 lads.
Yeah.
And a sister. Sister used to help Mum in the dairy.
So your father do the ploughing, would he?
Father did all the ploughing, and as we were getting into our early teens, we would take over, do the horsework, and he would do the bossing. Nobody bothered, you know, nobody had to shout at you to do such and such a thing.
No.
You just did it. It was just normal, routine family work.
Now, while you were doing all this, the mill was presumably, was that in operation?
That was in operation. It was run by a chap, a Mr. Quaggan from Union Mills. He was the pinfold keeper for Union Mills area, which means stray animals were put in this pinfold just up on the road towards the Strang, and you had to go and pay him to get them out if they were your animals.
I know that pinfold well, of course, yes. Yeah.
Now then, he was run the mill here, but when we moved out, after the 10-year lease was up, the landlord, Quilliam, wanted his son to take over, so he put the rent up on Dad. Well, Dad was such a good farmer that the farm turned out to be really productive.
Yeah.
And they thought the son wouldn't have much to do, but the son, well, I'm not saying anything, but he was not a good farmer, shall we say. So the farm was sold after a couple of years to the Forestry Board.
All right.
Who still have it now. Most of it is a forestry nursery.
Yes.
But the two fields below the Foxdale, what was the Foxdale railway line, are the parish sports fields, the cricket field,
yeah.
And the other ones being organised for all sorts of sports.
Well, we're just sitting not so far from what would be
Foxdale
the Foxdale River.
Yeah, which
that provided the water for the mill, did it?
There was a...
It'd be a mill race?
A mill race was bleeding off the river, just up the road a wee bit, would come down over to the mill, turn the wheel, the water wheel on the mill, to work the machinery inside, where there were stone, big stone flat
mill wheels.
Which crushed the corn, turned out the flour or whatever.
Yeah.
It did quite a few jobs.
Was it quite busy then?
It is. It was a full-time job.
Yeah.
It was going all the year round. Yes,
really?
It was very busy.
So some of your corn or grain crops would go to it as well?
Oh, yes. Every farm put his bit in. And a lot of the crushed oats and barley and wheat were used for cattle feeding.
Yeah.
But was just crushed. Like you would get peanuts now for birds. If you walk on them and crush them, the birds eat them better. If they don't, rather than the whole nut. The cattle used to love the crushed oats.
Did you put animals into the mart from here?
Yes, the mart was just down the road, where they're opposite the railway station.
So you didn't have to send them to Ramsey or anywhere else?
No. In fact, the St. John's Mart was one of the busiest on the island, basically because trains used to come in from Ramsey, Foxdale, Peel and Douglas, where the only other marts were Bullasulla and Ramsey. So St. John's, being the centre, was the busiest.
Yes.
A lot of the stock not sold to other farmers for breeding would be sold to butchers, and would be transported into Douglas on the train, special cattle trucks, on the train to the slaughterhouse in the Lake Road in Douglas. Yeah. Bobby Kinmey was the boss.
You'd get to know the station master here then, wouldn't you?
Well, the station master was George Crellin.
Yeah.
And his son Albert was the lorry driver, and Joe Mulcreest was the inspector. And outside of Douglas, it was the only station that had a station master and an inspector.
Yeah.
Because it was a junction station. Train would come out from Douglas and the carriages would be split up, two for Ramsey, two for Peel, and if needed, one for Foxdale. But the Foxdale line closed down just after the war, I think it was. In fact, I was one of the last to go up to help clear the station office out.
Oh, were you?
Mm.
Right.
And shortly afterwards, the track was taken up, the sleepers were lifted, and the bridge across the road just up from here was taken down.
The pillars for that are still there. The
pillars are still there. Marvellous stonework, the pillars, yes.
Anyway, the time came when you had to leave St. John's from this farm here and move on.
Well, we moved on after the 10-year lease was up. They wanted again to put the rent up, as I said. So we went poking around and we found this place at Dalby, which was called Seamount Farm, basically because the fields were in one row from the sea up to the top of the Dalby Mountain.
Right.
Again, 50 acres. And the house was lovely. Mum fell in love with the house because it was just the size she wanted. Well, we took it on a 10-year lease with a break at 5, which was very fortunate because this was in 1939.
Yeah.
2 years later, the Air Ministry bought 2 fields at the bottom near the sea to put radiolocation masts up.
Yes.
And Mum took the 3 iron steelworkers in as lodgers while they were building these, but at the end of the 5 years, Dad couldn't make it pay as a farm because the fields weren't enough, so we moved from there to Santon, to Bolivar in Santon.
So you remember those towers being built then?
Oh yes, in
because
fact,
the centres of those were timber, weren't they?
No, 2 of them were timber,
yeah,
and 2 of them were steel.
Right.
Now the timber ones went up to 240 feet, but the steel went up 325 feet.
Yeah.
And the buildings that the radiolocation equipment was in are still there.
Yeah.
They're covered in like a grass mound. And you look through, you can see the square entrance, concrete, buried in this soil.
Yeah.
And they're still there.
But you would have gone by the time they removed those masts because they had quite a job getting them down.
They didn't come down until well after the war, and we were away then, living in Santon.
Yeah.
In fact, I was away in the forces then.
Yeah.
But Dad was living in Santon then at Bolivar. That was quite a nice farm because the fields encircled the house.
Yes.
And the horses didn't have to travel far.
Well, you talk very fondly about this time, these farm years of your life.
Yes, it was a great, great life. Nobody ever rushed. There was an old Manx word, tre the lure. Which means take your time.
Yeah.
Do it properly, but take your time.
Yeah.
And Granny used to always come out with these Manx sayings. And there were two sisters lived just up the road from here in a little two-room cottage. And they were always dressed in black from head to toe. And if they came down to go to the shop, maybe once or twice a week, and they would knock on Granny's front door and she'd go and talk to them. They wouldn't come in. She'd just have to stand at the gate talking to them quite a while. And they come out with all these Manx sayings. And of course, I was always nosy. I was the nosy son. I'd be stood by listening, holding onto her skirts, listening to these things. It was a great life. It really was.
I only wish I could have recorded those two old ladies and your granny, but there we are.
Their name, Miss Gale or Miss Gill, I'm not sure. Mm. But I used to have to, when I came home from school, there was a 2-pint milk can with a lid on it, like you have a teapot lid today. Mm. And I had to take that full of milk up to the sisters. And I used to do this every day, but I never remember getting paid for it.
Yeah.
And of course, money wasn't everything in those days.
No.
If you were healthy and you had a good job, you enjoyed it, and that was it.
When you were at Molnacloy here then, you had, as you said, there was no electricity. What was the water situation?
There was no electricity, there was no gas, there was no sewerage. The water was a pump, or a hand pump, which was in the middle of the yard. You can still see where it was. But you had to pump the water up from about 40 feet below ground into a big cast iron barrel for the cows and the horses to drink out of, and the home to use in the kitchen.
Mm.
But it was lovely water, and there was always this old enamel mug hanging on the pump.
It was from a spring under the ground.
Yes, it really did taste lovely.
Yes.
There's no argument about that.
On that farm, as we looked at it at the entrance, there's a whitewashed building which comes right up to the road.
Yes.
Which, it's being suggested now, was once a courthouse, but you've no evidence of that.
Well, the gentleman living in there at the moment, Mr. Gibney and his wife and family, he's done a bit of research and said that he'd found evidence that it was once a courthouse. But he's going back hundreds of years, because it was before then a house was there, which was the farmhouse. Whether they took the farmhouse down and made it bigger into a courthouse, I don't know.
Mm.
But the house as it is today, the modern house, the stone-built house, was built at the turn of the century and has 4 bedrooms, 2 front rooms downstairs, which the children weren't allowed into, big kitchen at the back, and the dairy in the other corner.
Mm.
Quite a busy place.
Now, you're not so far from Slewallion then, just across the stream.
That's right.
That would be a playground for you, that was it?
Well, we used to go up Slewallion and what they call today skateboards.
Yeah.
To us was just a plank with a rope on the front. And we'd drag it up the top of the hill and lie on it and slide down the hill.
Yeah.
And story had it that there were 2 ladies tried in the courthouse here. This again could marry up with the story of the building and being in courthouse. They were tried in the courthouse and found to be witches.
Mm.
So they were taken up to Slewallion, put into barrels and rolled down the hill. And when they hit the hedge at the bottom where we used to stop, they were taken out dead and buried there. And today there are 2 thorn bushes there where the burials were. Now, whether this is just legend or story, I have no proof. But it was always told. As we were children, we were
always told. So you don't know whether to believe it or not?
I'm not arguing. No, I'm a Manxman. I don't argue with legend. I get on with it. Trail the lure.
Tell me a bit about the village of St. John's then, and the people, and the facilities, the shops and so on.
I think it was in the 1500s when the Tin World moved to St. John's for its yearly ceremony. I'm not too sure of the date, but about that period. And at that time, St. John's was looked on as the main village on the island. It had, as we said, what we surmised was a courthouse, a post office, a shop, a church, lovely big church, which is still in very often in use, church hall, a chapel, we were all Methodists, chapel hall, and a fairground at the front where we had all our sports.
Mm.
And 3 pubs. Now, I haven't said that were 3 pubs and only a small village. Basically, because on Mart Day, the farmers would come from all over the place after the sales at the Mart they would all finish up in the pub having a pint.
Yes.
And that would be them until next week.
Right.
But the three pubs were always busy on a mart day.
What was there in the way of a smithies then?
There were three smithies. There was one here, just by...
Down at the mill here?
Just by. Well, part of it was the smithy.
Hmm.
There's a smithy at Ballacrane.
Yeah.
Where there's... used to be petrol pumps. I think it's still no... It's a garage at the moment, the smithy garage. And then there was another one by the chapel, between the chapel and the Sunday school, in the village itself. That was run by Garrett's family.
Right.
And, of course, there was plenty of work for smiths in those days, with the horses and the farms, and all the farm implements having to be sharpened and ploughshares recut and all this. You know, it was very busy.
So if you wanted a cartwheel, I mean, would a smith be good enough to work as a wheelwright as well?
I don't think he could do a wheelwright's work, no. That was more of a carpenter's job.
Yeah.
But he could make the steel rim for the wheel.
Right.
So the carpenter would have to turn out the hub and the spokes, and the smith would turn out the wheel. But the smith was doing all the... horse's harness was basically short bits of chain, which were coupled to the different machines for the horse to pull. Well, he could make these chain couplings, as they were called. He could repair the horse's harness. And our jobs was to polish the horse's harness and the brasses. They had to look spot on. Didn't matter what we looked like, as long as the horses looked good.
If there was spare parts needed for some of these implements, a smithy would soon knock them together, wouldn't
it? Well, you couldn't, as it were, go into Douglas and order one.
Mm.
You would have to go to the smith with the broken object and he would turn one out for you.
Yes.
And it was great for children to stand there and watch him getting the irons hot and over the anvil, knocking them into shape, you know.
They never minded kids watching, did they?
No. The children knew that they had to stand back.
Yes.
When he took it to the anvil.
That's right.
But up to going to the anvil, it was a great, an opportunity for education. To know that a piece of strip of iron could be turned into a horseshoe, impregnated with nail holes and the lot.
Yeah. When you were youngsters then, there'd be no shortage of food, so you'd have plenty of eggs and chicken and all that sort of thing.
Well, when you got home from school, always a big meal in the evening, because the family were too busy during the day on the farm.
Mm.
So there was a big meal in the evening, and after that, the fire would be stoked up, log fire. Visitors would come visiting from the cottages round about, knowing that the kettle was on the hob, as it were, cups of tea or coffee.
Yeah.
And they'd be all sitting there talking, and us children would be sitting in front of the fire on a rug, listening. And this is where I think we've got most of our knowledge from, by just listening to them talking. And I had a puppy, Jip, it was a collie, and it used to come in and the family used to chase it away, but it would come up behind me and lick the back of my neck and come round for a cuddle, and I would hold it in front of the fire then.
Yeah.
We loved it, really, really lovely.
And this was a sort of family atmosphere, family get-together, but I mean, there must have been some discipline. You'd have to go to bed at certain times, wouldn't you? And you'd have to, as you said, one room you weren't allowed to go in.
The front room. Now, the front room was kept basically for family weddings or funerals or get-togethers when everyone was dressed up in their best suits.
Well, what'd be in there, a piano or an organ or anything like that?
It could have been an organ. We had no piano. There was an organ, a big fireplace,
and
what they called a dresser, which was full of the family cups and saucers and broth pots and God knows what. Everything was in this dresser.
Yeah.
And, of course, the children weren't allowed near it.
Mm.
If you touched anything, get out of here.
And what was bedtime?
About 8 o'clock.
Mm.
8 to 9 o'clock, because you had no TV, radio, you had no entertainment, whatever, only what the family gave you. In later years, when we moved out to Derby, just before the war, this chap from Peel Partington came out renting these radios, battery sets. It was a large dry battery and a wet battery, as it was called.
Mm.
And he would have to come out every week and change the wet battery because it was going flat.
Yeah.
But to tune in to any station was just haphazard and good luck if you got a good one. So Mum used to tune in till she got some nice music and leave it at that.
Yes.
But I never remember any news broadcasts or whatever.
No.
Just music, you know. But it was something new.
What did you do for relaxation and entertainment outside of that? I mean, church halls and that sort of thing, probably.
Well, we used to gang up in weather like this, lovely weather. Gang of us would go down to the Niabo beach and walk along the cliff paths towards the Craig to Eri Cushlan, looking for anything washed up on the shores, you know. Quite often you would find some object that was looked funny or didn't, should be there.
Yeah.
But we never bothered to bring it home because we were told never to pick these things up, because during the war, of course, mines got washed up.
Yes.
So we were told not to pick anything up.